We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, show Alternative Visions. Okay, today I'm going to go solo again, and the topic is corporate strategy. You know, we've been having shows here periodically throughout the year, and last week we had a panel discussion on labor strategy, union strategy. Is union strategy at a strategic impasse? And most of my guests agreed, impasse meaning going nowhere, meaning not very successful. And we looked at three dimensions of that strategy last week and in previous shows. That is organizing membership, retaining membership. We looked at bargaining effectiveness. And we also looked at political action and the lack of effectiveness thereof. Okay, that was the three dimensions of union strategy at an impasse, going nowhere. Same strategies for decades now. If you don't need any more time to figure out that something's not working, I don't know what the answer is there. But we'll talk about that some more here. But we want to talk about corporate strategy. We want to focus on the other side. What's been happening for the last four decades? Okay, I want to digress a little before I jump into that, though, because I want to talk just briefly about some events of the past week here. One is we got a jobs report yesterday. Another is we got a revision of the U.S. GDP report. And then, of course, we have developments over in Europe with the central bank, European Central Bank there, that will have an impact as well. Okay, so briefly on those three events of the week. Job report came out yesterday. U.S. created 142,000 jobs. You know, it takes 150 just to absorb new people entering the labor force. But they were all predicting 240,000 jobs. All these economists and forecasters were saying, oh, we're going to have 240,000 jobs. Well, they only were 100,000 short. Now, what that tells you is these economists and forecasters aren't worth a damn. They're just guessing. Or there's something wrong with the numbers. Or maybe a little bit of both, one or the other. I'm not sure which one it is too much, although I've been sort of poking at the edges of the reliability of some of these statistics that are coming out of the U.S. government in various forms here and there, particularly the jobs report. I think since we've had this crisis in the 6-7 years ago, the labor markets have changed so much they don't really understand what they're doing. And the methods that they've used to calculate job growth aren't as accurate as they used to be. So that what you've got is seasonal swings in the numbers. Some months you get far more job statistics showing far more jobs created than actually are, and vice versa on the downside. Anyway, I don't want to get into the details of that. I've talked about that a year or so ago. But what's important is the labor force participation rate. That is how many people who are eligible age, who could work, aren't working, who are dropping out of the labor force. You know, they make a big deal of these 200,000 plus job creation in the last 6 months. But the labor force participation rate is dropping down. In other words, there are as many people going out one end, dropping out of the labor force, as they are hiring in one the other end. Labor force participation rate has dropped since the crisis here from 66.67, whatever it is, to roughly 62, 63, about a 4% drop in labor force participation rate. Well, why is that important? Because 4% of 155 million people in the labor force is, guess what? 6 million people. 6 million people dropped out of the labor force. Well, that's about the number of jobs we've hired. Sounds like a big churn to me. you know, they're not talking about that churning out. They just talk about the jobs that come in. And by the way, the jobs are mostly contingent, part-time, temp, low-paid jobs, non-union jobs. So we got a churning in the labor force going on. And you know, Janet Yellen of the Federal Reserve and those folks, they know. They know what all this means. They're not going to tell you what it means. But they know the labor market and the job market is a mess, and still is, regardless of all their predictions and all their estimations of job creation. But, you know, we're going to see a weakening of job creation going forward. Now, the GDP report, what can we say about that? Well, 4.2% here this past spring, April, June, following a 2.9%. Or 2.2% adjusted, collapse. Ooh, big seesaw, big volatility. Why did it happen? Well, it has to do with the reasons why it collapsed in the first quarter are the same reasons why it recovered in the second quarter, and that is inventories, business spending on inventories, and on exports. Yeah, that all collapsed in the first quarter of this year. And state and local government spending, you know, all went down, and now it all sort of snapped back a little bit. Well, this is also this stop-go, seesaw, volatility situation we have in this economy for 6 years now. Look, if you go back to 2013, third quarter 2013, another big inventory buildup and some export gains, manufacturing export gains, third quarter. Well, about a year ago, right? Why did business build up inventories? Because they thought, oh, the consumer is going to take off here around Christmas, fourth quarter, so let's build up our inventories so we can satisfy the growing demand, right? Well, Christmas sales were flat. Fourth quarter was not very good. And then business pulls back, reduces inventories, and boom, there goes your GDP down. Same thing happened to exports. Okay, U.S. exports didn't do so well last year, and well, at the end of last year, and they picked up at the beginning of this year. Well, why did they pick up? Because other currencies like the euro and the yuan rose, made the U.S. Currency lower, which means you lower your cost of your exports, and you can sell more. So exports recover because the other countries are doing worse. Oh, but what's happened is in the second quarter, we have a reversal of that. So we have an increase in exports. But look, you know, exports are now, U.S. exports are now softening once again. And if we don't get the consumer to buy, then the inventory picture will soften again, which I think is going to happen. All right. And then we have the European Central Bank situation. And the chair of the central bank, Janet Yellen's counterpart, Mario Draghi, pumping another $1 trillion into the European economy, which will have no effect on the real economy in Europe, just as money injections in the U.S. and Japan have no effect on the real economy. It will stimulate the stock market. And that's really what it's all about, so that investors can make some money here. Okay, so that's just my round robin here on some important things in next week. Let's get back to this whole question of corporate strategy. You know, we don't pay enough attention to that and look at it in its historical perspective and what's really been going on. So what do we mean by corporate strategy? Well, that strategy really has several dimensions to that. You could say, well, what's the strategy of U.S. capitalists vis-a-vis their competitors? And in the 1970s, because we got to go back to the 1970s to understand what's happening today. Today is just a continuation of the major strategic shift by corporate America, U.S. capitalists, same thing, a.k.a., in the 1970s that was developed and implemented in the 70s. And that corporate strategy has evolved over the last four decades, but still fundamentally the same in its major dimensions. And one of the dimensions is how do they change the way they dealt with their capitalist competitors, the Europeans, the Japanese, i.e., what changed in terms of banking and foreign direct investment, trade, and so forth. The second element here was what was the changes in the strategy in relationship to the old USSR and China and Cuba and others? What was their changed relationship or strategy for emerging markets? Excuse me. The rest of the world, in other words. How are they going to exploit better the rest of the world? But then the fourth element was, what's their domestic? How did they change domestically within the U.S., in other words? What did they do strategically that was different to target unions and labor and workers in order to tame them and take back some of the gains that unions and workers had achieved in the 60s and 70s? Okay. Once again, this all fits with last week's show where we talked about American labor's strategic impasse, but now we're looking at the corporate side of all this. So let's talk about that corporate strategy, capitalist strategy, call a spade a spade, in the 1970s. What changed here? Well, what do we mean by strategy? Well, strategies are often confused. People confuse strategies with tactics and objectives. You know, you have a set of objectives. Strategy is about how you reach those objectives, your plan for reaching them. Tactics are how you implement the strategy. All right? Strategy is your plan to reach your goal and objectives. Let's give an example. A business plan. Let's look at the corporate side. You know, all businesses have business plans. What is that? A business plan is just a mix of the measures that will be taken to reach the stated goals of the company. Okay, well, those goals could be profit goals. They could be investment. Where are we going to invest? How much invest here or there? They could be market share. It could be a lot of things. It could be the primary objectives and goals. And the tactics are how that plan is implemented to reach those objectives. The tools for the strategy are tactics. For example, tactics could be like building a new plant, acquiring another company, foreign direct investment, layoffs, wage benefit cuts, whatever. Those are tactics in this example I'm giving here, this analogy, to understand what we mean when we talk about strategy. We can look at the same thing on the union side. What are the union's plans, right? The union plan for its objectives, right? The objectives could very well be increasing membership, retaining membership, improving the outcomes of collective bargaining, achieving a certain political goal, legislative goal or something, right? Those are the objectives, but the strategy is how you're going to do that, right? And the tactics will be how you implement the strategy. Tactics would be strikes, boycotts, job actions, right? Political mobilization, influencing public opinion. Those would be the tactics. Now, we confuse tactics and strategy every day, all the time. But if you really want to understand why your strategy is not working, you've got to really understand what you're really talking about. People in the union movement, they talk about, oh, the strike's not working, strike's not working. Well, they're not looking at the strategy. Strike is just a tool for implementing a strategy. If your strategy isn't correct and not clear, then it doesn't matter what your tactic is. It may not the tactic may not fit the strategy. Okay, so that's just a little bit of a background before we jump into this whole idea of corporate strategy. So, strike strategy is a misnomer. Strike is the tactic, in other words, right? Okay, last week, you know, we talked about what's wrong with the union strategy, and we're continuing discussing that in the three important dimensions: organizing members, bargaining effectiveness, and political action. And my theme has been that they're all at an impasse now. They aren't producing any results. In fact, they're producing negative results. We're going backwards in labor. Right? In general, there are isolated examples of you know, new initiatives and aggressiveness and so forth. We have a great labor retreat going on for decades, but that does not mean defeat. There is resistance and fight back continuing along several fronts. Low-wage workers attempting to raise their wages and unionize, immigrants, workers raising demands and protesting, minimum wage fights and gains, scattered islands of resistance by teachers and public workers. But the main force of American labor is private sector trade union movement, as well as the vast majority of the still unorganized American working class, continue to experience a long retreat. And there's little signs of organized resistance in the face of what is an increasingly aggressive and overtly anti-union, anti-worker offensive by corporate America that continues today to expand and deepen. The origins of this offensive go back as far as the 1970s, and we'll explain why here in our discussion today. Okay, so something fundamentally is wrong with union strategies since the late 1970s. What is wrong? Well, to understand that, you've got to understand what has been right with corporate capitalist strategies, because you can't separate them. They're two sides of the same coin. If you want to understand what's wrong in your house, you've got to understand why and how someone else is upsetting everything, right? There's a tendency on the labor side to focus on the problems and not have enough discussion on what are the solutions. You know, people in labor know organizing is a problem today. It has been for quite some time. New membership growth is difficult. Organizing the folks that want a union, and vast majority of people want a union, when working class folks, you talk to them, today, so it's not a problem that they don't want unions. They do. We just can't link up with them and make it happen for a variety of reasons here. A lot of them have to do with the corporate side resisting it. Okay. So the point of today's show, union failure, strategic failure in these three dimensions, right, is partly due to unions' own strategies that have failed. But it's not just due to unions. It's due also to the inordinate successes of corporate strategy at the same time. Right? So today we want to look at corporate strategy, especially that part focused on holding back, destroying unions, turning collective bargaining into a tool not for wage and benefit gains, but for wage and benefit reduction, and neutralizing labor's political influence as simultaneously corporate America significantly expands its own political influence. Okay, let's look at the results here just for union organizing and memberships. Union membership has collapsed. Going back to 1980, 22% of the workforce were in unions. That workforce was about 90 million people at the time. So there's about 20 million, just under 20 million people out of 90 million were in unions in 1980. Today, instead of 22% of the workforce organized, it's 11.3%. And in the private sector, it's 6.7%. The workforce has grown from 90 million to 155 million. And today, we only have 14.5 million people in unions. In other words, with a 90 million workforce, we had 20 million organized in 1980. With a 156 million workforce, we have 5 million less, 14.5 million. We've not only failed to organize the labor force as it continues to grow, but we've net lost. In other words, if we had 22% of the workforce organized today, there'd be 35 million people in unions instead of the 14.5 million. So we've lost 20 million people. Well, that's a failure by any measure. But the failure is not just that unions have not raised an effective strategy to organize and retain members. The failure is because of the resistance as well, and the successful strategy to stop union organizing and roll back membership by corporate America. Okay. So we need to understand how they did it. We also need to understand how we've gone from collective bargaining prior to 1980, in which wages were continually increased, benefits were increased, and union worker rights were expanded, to what we've got today, ever since the 1980s, of concessions. Concessions on wages in various ways, shapes, and forms, concessions on benefits, and a rise in management rights at the expense of union and worker rights in collective bargaining agreements. How did this happen? How did this huge reversal in membership happen? How did this change in collective bargaining happen? And how did labor lose any semblance of political influence? You know, prior to the 80s, the U.S. Labor movement was able to influence political legislation and outcome. Now it cannot even defend against the corporate legislative assault. And we see that assault at the federal government level, free trade and so forth, failure of card check, and at the state level, right, with ALEC, right, corporate ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, run by the Koch brothers and other billionaires. Billionaires are involved in politics everywhere now, overtly. And the rise of the open shop movement, which destroys union membership and bargaining effectiveness, and public workers being rolled back in numbers and collective bargaining and benefits everywhere. Okay. The point, once again, is that this situation, this reversal on all these three critical fronts, political influence, collective bargaining effectiveness, and union membership, is partly due to labor's own failed strategies, but it's also significantly due to the successes of the corporate strategy. In other words, you cannot separate them. That corporate offensive that rolled out in the 1970s, that took form in the 1970s, implemented in the 1980s, has been a juggernaut ever since, and labor has come up with no answer to it, and it's rolling on and morphing into new, different forms in different ways, and labor's on the defensive and being rolled back. Okay, but today we want to focus on that corporate strategy successfully. Now, one other point, well, two other points I want to make before we jump into specific examples of that strategy. And one is that that corporate offensive that was put together in the 1970s and has rolled on ever since, it has been associated with a reorganization and a restructuring of American capital in the 1970s and early 80s. Reorganization was necessary to implement this new corporate strategy. Now, conversely, union failure to deal with that corporate offensive has something to do with the fact that labor did not also reorganize and restructure itself to better effectively defend against that corporate offensive. You know, if you go back in U.S. labor history, periodically, labor has reorganized itself. There were the Knights of Labor that come out of the Civil War. That was a certain form of organization, effective for a while, but then when you have this big corporate offensive in the 1870s, not very effective. Out of that, though, the response to that is the American Federation of Labor in the 1880s and 90s. And out of that, in the next crisis in the 1890s, you have the push towards industrial unionism, the National Railway Union, IWW, and ultimately the CIO. So labor has reorganized and restructured in response to these corporate offenses periodically as well, as capitalists have reorganized and changed their strategy. Except now for the last four decades, when the capitalists did their reorganization restructuring to implement their new strategies, labor has sat back on its butt and has not reorganized itself in order to change its own strategies to defend against the corporate onslaught. That's a fundamental strategic historical fact. Organization has something to do with strategic effectiveness. And we're not seeing it on the union side, but we have seen it very clearly on the corporate side that I'll describe. Now, some people, one more addendum here. Some people say, what you're talking about is neoliberalism. Well, I don't like that term. Neoliberalism, what is neoliberalism? They're saying, that's the, how corporate, in the 1980s, corporations, capitalists in America, reoriented themselves to take on their global capitalist competitors better, right, and find new ways to exploit the third world here, emerging markets, and new domestic policies and more direct political control, etc. That's neoliberalism, right? Sometimes called Thatcherism from the Prime Minister of Britain at the time, or Reaganism, Thatcher-Reaganism, neoliberalism. They're all the same, okay? But it's a bad concept. Causes confusion, I think. It's a creation of intellectuals, academics and left intellectuals, neoliberalism. The problem is the word liberalism. You know, they understand that liberalism is really kind of a free market focus going back to the 18th century. But the general public thinks liberalism is progressive. You know, it's for social programs and so on and so forth. So when you talk about neoliberalism, what you got to do is re-explain the term before you start explaining the facts, which is confusing for folks, average folks, right? And by the way, that's the nature of ideology, to change conceptually and redefine the facts and your conceptual apparatus so that people remain confused, right? So call it really what it is. This is the corporate capitalist offensive that was launched in the 1970s and has gained momentum ever since. Okay, this means there's an economic class war intensified in the U.S. There's always been a class war, sometimes muted, but very clearly we got a class war going on at least for the last four decades that has been intensifying. You know, about a decade ago, Warren Buffett, you know, the multi big billionaire, maybe the richest guy in the U.S. here, quoted, this is a decade ago, 25 years after the offensive had been rolling. Buffett said that, there's a class war in America. My class is winning. Whoa, that created a little bit of stir. You know, the veil came off. Oh, gee, the capitalists are aware they're engaging in an economic class war with the workers of this country. Only the workers aren't aware, right? Well, if you're on the line, you're aware, whether you call it class war or not. All right, that was 10 years ago, and the class war has really intensified under George Bush and under Barack Obama. And we see the outcomes of that class war from the 1970s launched very clearly in this membership drop, which has accelerated since 2000, a wage decline, average median family wages and income has been dropping 1%, 2% per year, even before the 2008-09 crash, benefits are being struck down everywhere. You know, Obama's ACA is all about a slow roll destruction of union negotiated employer plans and getting people to ration health care for themselves. You know, they make a big deal about all the people signed up on ACA. Yeah, 9-10 million out of 50 million. They say, we've reduced spending, health care spending. Well, yeah, because everyone's signing up for these huge deductible plans. That's the only thing they can afford on the ACA. Huge, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 deductibles. And if you got that kind of a deductible, you pay the first $5,000, so you're going to ration yourself. You're not going to go and use the healthcare system when you got to pay as much out of pocket. So people go and they don't really get good healthcare because they're putting things off too much. But that's what's happening here. People can't afford good benefits. And people who do have benefits in their union negotiated plans, those are going to be destroyed pretty soon. 2018, 40% tax. That's the end on union negotiated health care plans. Everyone's going to be pushed off into going and buying your own, huge deductible. And employers are going to wash their hands of this whole thing, just as they've been washing their hands of defined benefit pensions now for a couple of decades. They're almost gone. So rolling back of wages, rolling back of benefits, and, of course, what you don't see is a rollback of union and worker rights and bargaining agreements and a rise of management rights and bargaining agreements. Okay, so this is the economic class war, and it's continuing to expand. And now it's morphing into more of a political war. We see all around us all these movements to restrict voting rights going on. We see all kinds of limitations being put piecemeal on First Amendment rights, whether it's free speech or assembly or whatever. You know, you can't assemble like you used to and protest. They got the SWAT teams coming down on you from all directions now. Militarization of police. We talked about that a few weeks back, right? Journalists are being thrown in jail because they won't reveal their sources. There's all kind of assaults on First Amendment going on. Right? Corporate money corruption is accelerating from, you know, Citizens United, McCulloch, all these decisions coming down, making billionaires even more able to buy the system. We've got 30,000 lobbyists running around Washington, D.C., 30,000 of them, you know, like cockroaches in the bathroom in Maryland. There, you turn the light on, they all run all different directions. Well, Washington, D.C. is a big bathroom full of lobbyist cockroaches running around. And billionaires, civil liberties rollback, surveillance, you know, this is all part of a piecemeal morphing of a class war into political forms. Okay, but the whole thing begins back in the 1970s. You've got to understand your history. You've got to understand both what has gone wrong on the union side and what has gone right for capitalists on the corporate side. And we're going to get right to that, but we're going to take a little break first. And then we're going to start with what happened in the 1970s and since in this corporate offensive against workers in this country. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We'll be back and jump right into the facts and figures. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. We're talking about corporate strategy in America, and we want to take an historical approach to this because people need to know this class war going on for four decades now has its origins in the 1970s, not under Reagan. Reagan just implemented what was put together in the 1970s by corporate America. You know, he took it and ran with it, but it really began to form in the 1970s, and that's the period as well that corporate America, capitalist America, reorganized itself. So once again, this organization question is closely related to strategic effectiveness. But let's start. Let's go back and look at how this thing evolved in the 1970s. The initial targets of corporate America were, one, the building trade unions, construction unions, the Teamsters, and the auto workers. Okay. Corporate strategy targeting the unions is twofold. One, on one hand, it's to prevent successful union organizing that would add new members to labor's ranks, and the other, to reduce membership in unions where it already exists. And both strategic thrusts were resurrected in new forms in the 1970s. Okay. In 1970-71, the building trades unions went on strike and achieved major, often double-digit wage and benefit gains. Double-digit. Okay, I'm not talking about 2-3%. I'm talking about 10-20% gains in 1970s. These building trades unions' successes were in part because the building trades had unified and they had regional contracts. You know, like there was a contract for all Northern California, and all construction employers in Northern California had to go along with that agreement. So, you know, there was like an amalgamation, aggregation of smaller collective bargaining agreements into major agreements where all the unions could strike together in solidarity if they had to. And the employers tended to be smaller employers and couldn't engage in runaway shops or anything like that. So union-powered, strike power and negotiating power was greater than the smaller employers. And by the 1970s, we had had all this inflation in the 60s because of the Vietnam War, and unions had self-imposed wage restraint on themselves because the Democratic Party had asked them to. But, you know, by 1970, they couldn't wait anymore. So they started trying to catch up with the inflation of the 60s, and they did. They were successful. And the building trades led the fight. And the building trades had these significant gains. Now, construction sites, you got to remember, who delivers the stuff to construction sites? Well, the Teamsters Union. Teamster members deliver the stuff. So they deliver, you know, all the materials to the site, and they see these guys winning these big gains, and they say, well, gee, we're just as important as them. We should have similar gains. So the huge increases, catch up, but still huge, in building trades spilled over into Teamster negotiations. Now, you got to remember, too, that the Teamsters Union also had a national contract, an over-the-road trucking agreement. Right? So they had significant power to shut down trucking across the country if they wanted to at the time, just as building trades could do it significantly regionally. And what we see here is not only we have these large regional and national bargaining agreements, but what we're seeing when it spills over from building trades to Teamsters, this is called pattern bargaining, and it's cross-industry pattern bargaining. The combination of these large agreements and mostly unionized at the time, you know, building trades and Teamsters and everything, they had about 60, 70, 80% of their industry organized, unionized. There's 22% for the entire economy, but in these core powerful bastions of unionism, building trades, Teamsters, manufacturing, the unionization was well over 50%. So it spills over to the Teamsters, cross-industry pattern bargaining. Teamsters go on strike, get big gains. Now, the Teamsters also deliver stuff to the auto plants. You know, parts have to come in and cars have to come out. So the auto workers, whose negotiations were up at the time, say, well, gee, we should get double-digit increases, too. So it spills over then from the Teamsters to auto. And, of course, from auto it goes to other manufacturings. So this this combination of national contracts, also in auto, and pattern bargaining within industries and across industries, and the fact that you had such a massive unionization, and you had leaders who were willing to go on strike, you still had, in many cases, the leadership from you know, the 30s and 40s, still at the top of the unions. This was a combination that proved very successful. The 1970-71-72 strike wave was the most successful bargaining strike wave in U.S. post-war history, even more successful than 1946. In 1946, it was after World War II, and there was a readjustment going on in the economy and so forth. You didn't have as great historic gains in wages and benefits. It was typical in 1970-71 for these unions in these strategic sectors to have wage and benefit increases of 20% in the first year of what was a normal three-year contract at the time. 20%. Contrast that with today, where people are giving up wages. Corporate America could not deal with it. So they turned to their politicians, at the time Nixon, who imposed a wage freeze. and then imposed wage controls, rolled back some of these 20% gains to only 5.5%. In other words, they had to call in their capitalist state to do the dirty work for them, to stop it. Well, they did stop it, and immediately after wage controls and so forth, inflation took off, and that undercut some of the gains, and then we had the worst recession, 73-75, up to that point. That took back more of the gains. But the employers started organizing as well, particularly the construction industry employers. They formed what was called the Construction Industry Roundtable. And their plan was, how do we bust the construction building trade unions to prevent this? What they came up with was a two-part strategy in the 1970s. This is occurring in early 1970s. One was called double-breasted operations, which has become a pattern ever since. Double-breasted operations mean, okay, we have this company that's unionized. This is a construction company, unionized, and it does the construction within the city, you know, commercial projects and so forth. But let's set up an alternative company that's not unionized, double-breasted, two sides, you see. And we'll have that company, non-union company, and deal with the construction in the suburbs, the housing construction and so forth. It'll run as non-union. And over time, we will slowly reduce the work for the union and shift it to the non-union operations. And then workers will be concerned that, their jobs may be shifted even further to the non-union operations. Therefore, we better hold back on strike. It's kind of like offshoring within the U.S., right? You don't move offshore, you just move off to the suburbs. And by the time the union leadership got control of this, a sense of what was going on, and tried to do something about it, they would go and picket these non-union operations and try to get them to go union. Well, this is where the second part of the strategy came in, and what these employers did was lobby their friends in Congress and the courts and so forth, and prevented the picketing. Well, unions responded, well, we got to then do it legislatively. We've got to get a situs picketing bill. And that was one of labor's big demands, a site picketing bill, to allow picketing of these double-breasted operations. And that legislation came up, and Jimmy Carter did not really support it. And Congress, Democrats in Congress in 1978 chickened out. What happened was the situs picketing bill was shot down. A lot of legislation was shut down in the late 70s. Both on the social front, you know, environmental and legislation and social legislation, women's rights and so forth. A lot of things got shut down in the late 70s because, as we'll see, by the late 70s, the corporate interest had reorganized and restructured themselves. We'll talk about that shortly, and quite successfully. So the building trades were thwarted. They were checked in their counter-strategy to deal with this. And a lot of that had to do with that they relied totally on their so-called friends in the Democratic Party in Congress to bail them out, which they didn't. And, of course, we know that's been a long history for a long time now. All right, so by the late 1970s, the building trades were pretty much stymied, and their membership began to decline because it was dribbling out into the non-union operations that they couldn't stop. That was double-breasted operations. And that pretty much ended this cross-industry pattern bargaining that was led by the building trades union, who were, prior to all these changes, more powerful than their small building construction companies. A lot of solidarity, a lot of membership, both within the building trades and cross industry solidarity as well. But that was significantly undermined. What remained then was to break up nationwide bargaining agreements that existed in manufacturing and transport. That is, in the trucking, airlines, dock workers, longshoring, particularly on the East Coast. and then to break up pattern bargaining within these industries in manufacturing, i.e. in autos and steel and other segments of manufacturing. And corporate America began planning to do just that in the late 1970s as well. One way to do that was to deregulate the trucking and airline industries. And the other way was to stop investing in manufacturing in the U.S. and use that as a pretext for getting tax cuts to get the government taxpayer to pay for manufacturing companies to move to the South and then offshore. Okay. So the double-breasted operations and picketing restrictions and construction, to that you add a strategy that deregulates trucking and sets in motion a offshoring and runaway shop situation in manufacturing. So you take on all these three powerful sectors. And the 1978 was a threshold year for all this, right? We've already talked about the destruction of site picketing and other bills. But it was also at this time that these counter strategies aiming at transport and the Teamsters and aiming at auto workers and manufacturing were also in development. What happened was in 1980, even under Jimmy Carter, we have this deregulation of over-the-road trucking. The way you destroy the Teamsters Union or tame the Teamsters Union is twofold, right? What you do is deregulate and introduce competition. A lot of small trucking companies, and the trucking companies will lead the drive race to the bottom because now there's more competition. Now they start cutting wages. You cut wages by laying people off, and laying people off means you lose membership. So the whole deregulation of the trucking industry, over-the-road trucking, destroyed national bargaining in trucking and led to competition and wage and layoffs in trucking. At the same time, what you do is you put a mafia guy in charge of the Teamsters Union, Tony Provenzano, later convicted of being a mafia head in New Jersey there, and he does whatever the government and corporations want him to do. So that was a big blow to the Teamsters Union. So that critical Teamster connection in cross-industry pattern bargaining between building trades and manufacturing was broken. Then you go after the manufacturing unions themselves. And the test case here was the Chrysler Corporation bankruptcy in 1979. What Chrysler and a lot of other manufacturing companies did in the 1970s was refuse to invest in automotive plants in the U.S. And then to use that fact that, oh, we can't compete, we got to reinvest, and as an excuse for the government, under Carter, then really under Reagan, to give them tax cuts, to invest in accelerated depreciation write-offs, in other words, pay for their reinvestment, and to do it in such a way that allowed these companies, did not require them to reinvest where they were in the plants that they had, but they could abandon those plants and go south, and then even go offshore. In other words, tax cuts to move jobs offshore. And that still exists to this day. Right? American workers are giving up taxes so they can lose their jobs. People aren't aware of that much, but that's what's going on for now for decades. Okay. So the Chrysler test case meant that, Chrysler's going bankrupt because it's not investing. Government's got to bail them out. But look, you auto workers have to pay part of the price of the bailout, too. In other words, you got to give up membership and reduce your worker ranks and give up wages and wage increases in order to save Chrysler. Well, it was so successful that the Chrysler deal, that the rest of the manufacturing unions, you know, who were pushing then for tax cuts to reinvest elsewhere, say, oh, gee, this is a model that works, right? Let's let the industry plant that we have become so uncompetitive, say we're going to have to shut it down. Government comes in, gives us some tax bennies, and put some weight through the Democratic Party on labor leaders. Labor leaders in turn said, okay, you guys, you've got to agree to wage cuts and layoffs, or you're going to lose your jobs. okay, now we got double-breasted operation, but double-breasted in the sense of, okay, we'll keep the union reduced where it is, and we'll go to non-union first in the South, run to the Sun Belt, and then we're going to pass free trade, then we're going to run to Mexico, then we're going to give China preferred nation trading rights to run to China with your jobs and elsewhere around the world. So it's global double-breasted operations, right? And we see double-breasted operations, really, in the trucking, right? We set up a non-union trucking. We deregulate, and that stimulates non-union trucking companies. So this is a preferred strategy of how you destroy unions. You set up non-union parallel operations, and you threaten people with their jobs. As a result, they become scared. That spills over into concession bargaining on the bargaining front. And as you lose members, with all this, unions lose members, then their political influence declines, and they become even more dependent on the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party knows they're dependent, so they deliver even less to them in terms of results. But you got nowhere else to go, so you're in a downward political spiral, as well as a downward bargaining spiral, as well as a membership spiral. All these strategies are related to each other. You know, they're not separate. Collapse of one produces a collapse in the other, and vice versa. Right. So redirecting investment to manufacturing led to the deindustrialization of the union of U.S. manufacturing in the Northeast and Great Lakes region, called the runaway shop. Right. That led to a corresponding collapse in union membership in manufacturing in those areas, and the reestablishment in non-union Sun Belt, and then elsewhere, you know, Mexico and Canada even, and the rest of the world, even more membership collapse. These strategies that I've just described took a major toll on union membership, starting from the late 70s on. So the destruction of union membership in this country, the data and statistics I gave earlier, is not simply because unions aren't organizing, right? It's because the employers have a more powerful strategy, and they're destroying membership. If there's a failure on the union side, it's a failure to change their approach to effectively confront this corporate offensive. At the same time, we got union-busting law firms and the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, that are also gutting union membership. Well, union busting means this whole industry of law firms to prevent new unionization and to eliminate the unions where they already exist. So the NLRB, the government, becomes an important point of attack on all this as well. But none of this could have happened without corporate reorganization in the 1970s. What was that reorganization? Well, we talked about the Construction Industry Roundtable that was successful attacking building trades. But then the large corporations, largest 100 corporations, mostly multinationals, reorganized themselves into a new organization called the Business Council and the Business Roundtable. Construction employers later joined the roundtable. And later, the roundtable and council merged effectively with other pre-70 groups like Chamber of Commerce, and National Association of Manufacturers, National Federation of Independent Businesses, and so forth. You know, they're all uniting. It's solidarity, yes, on the capitalist side, right? This was the new reorganization, the strategic thrust. Out of this reorganization came a new political strategy. CEOs of the largest U.S. corporations, right, who led and chaired the Business Council and Roundtable, traditionally did not engage in direct business lobbying up until the 1970s. Surveys after that showed that the CEOs spend 50% of their time political lobbying, and that's still going on. Corporate America forged new alliances with the religious right, direct fund, political fundraisers, right? Wealthy investors in its ranks created various think tanks that arose at the time. And, you know, they produced the message that's handed out to the media. And then, of course, we have deregulation and we have new media, and cable TV, radio becomes very right-wing, enabled by deregulation of the communications industry, right? And then we get the Reagan Revolution and tax cuts that funds all of this for corporations, right? And attacks their Japanese and European competitors effectively in the 1980s, expands this corporate strategy by creating free trade. Free trade is really designed to accelerate offshoring. You know, corporations are given tax incentives to go offshore, which they do. And then we pass free trade, which allows them to ship back the goods they produce in Shanghai back to the United States without any tariffs or taxes. Free trade is just an extension of offshoring, and it accelerates offshoring. And offshoring means devastation, further devastation of union membership in manufacturing, right? And we do the same thing with the quasi-free trade with China and PNTR. At the same time, the NLRB is also continuing to destroy union membership by passing rules and regulations that say, okay, even those are union members who are in bargaining units, well, they no longer can be in a bargaining unit. We've got to exempt the professional skilled workers, take them out of the bargaining unit because they have no community of interest. So they start gutting around the edges of the bargaining units and membership. And then they say, well, all these temp employees have no community of interest, and all these industrial contractors have no community of interest with the workers. Therefore, they can't unionize. And employers then, you know, just create more temp workers and more lay off folks and let them be industrial contractors, you know. We see that gutting the Teamsters union in particular, independent drivers. Okay, so, you know, we have an offensive on all fronts here, and that has a lot to do with the destruction of labor membership here. You know, I haven't talked about the open shop and public workers offensive. That destroys it in the last decade even further. It's an ongoing offensive to undermine unionism and union members, and when you gut the union membership, then you have no bargaining power. You make people afraid. They agree to concessions. And as unions get weaker, then the Democratic Party takes them for granted even more. So now we're in a downward spiral. And the important point of all this is to understand that the corporate offensive launched in the 70s has a lot to do with labor's strategic impasse. It's not just the unions have failed to confront it, which they have. Therefore, they are partly responsible. But it's bigger picture than that. Okay, so we got to reorganize and come up with new strategies in the union movement. I'll talk about that, and I'm writing about that in Telesur, on my website, and in the new book as well. So stay tuned. We'll talk about this some more. But keep in mind, it's the corporations, not just the unions, that are behind the rollback, the class war, and the growing income inequality in America. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Talk to you next week.